Somewhere in Italy, a snake has children. He calls his children Thomas. They carry in their heads pictures of the Thames, of muddy, shallow banks beyond the reach of the tide, beyond the wash of the water. Next morning, when he wakes, Liz is still sleeping. The sheets are damp. She is warm and flushed, her face smooth like a young girl's. He kisses her hairline. She tastes of salt. She murmurs, "Tell me when you're coming home." "Liz, I'm not going," he says. "I'm not going with Wolsey." He leaves her. His barber comes to shave him. He sees his own eyes in a polished mirror. They look alive, serpent eyes. "What a strange dream," he says to himself. As he goes downstairs, he thinks he sees Liz following him. He thinks he sees the flash of her white cap. He turns and says, "Liz, go back to bed." But she's not there. He is mistaken. He picks up his papers and goes to Gray's Inn. It is recess. The business is not legal. The discussion is of texts and the whereabouts of Tyndale, somewhere in Germany. And the immediate problem is a fellow lawyer, so who shall say he should not be there, visiting Gray's Inn, called Thomas Bilney, who is a priest also, and a fellow of Trinity Hall. Little Bilney, he's called, on account of his short stature and worm-like attributes. He sits, twisting on a bench, and talking about his mission to lepers. "The scriptures, to me, are as honey," says little Bilney, swivelling his meagre bottom and kicking his shrunken legs. "I am drunk on the word of God." "For Christ's sake, man," he says, "don't think you can crawl out of your hole because the cardinal is away, because now the Bishop of London has his hands free, not to mention our friend in Chelsea."
"Masses, fasting, vigils, pardons out of purgatory, all useless," Bilney says. "This is revealed to me. All that remains, in effect, is to go to Rome and discuss it with His Holiness. I am sure he will come over to my way of thinking."
"You think your viewpoint is original, do you?" he says gloomily. "Still, at that, it may be, Father Bilney, if you think the Pope would welcome your advice in these matters." He goes out, saying, "There's one who will jump into the fire, given an invitation. Masters, be careful there." He doesn't take Rafe to these meetings. He will not draw any member of his household into dangerous company. The Cromwell household is as orthodox as any in London, and as pious. They must be, he says, irreproachable. The rest of the day is nothing to remember. He would have been home early if he had not arranged to meet up in the German enclave, the steelyard, with a man from Rostock, who brought along a friend from Stettin, who offered to teach him some Polish. "It's worse than Welsh," he says at the end of the evening. "I'll need a lot of practice. Come to my house," he says. "Give us notice and we'll pickle some herring, otherwise it's potluck." There's something wrong when you arrive home at dusk but torches are burning. The air is sweet, and you feel so well as you walk in, you feel young, unscarred. Then you see the dismayed faces. They turn away at the sight of you. Mercy comes and stands before him, but here is no mercy. "Say it," he begs her. She looks away when she says, "I am so sorry." He thinks it's Gregory. He thinks his son is dead. Then he half knows, because where is Liz? He begs her. "Say it."
"We looked for you. We said, Rafe, go and see if he's at Gray's Inn and bring him back, but the gatekeepers denied they'd seen you the whole day. Rafe said, trust me, I'll find him if I go over the whole city, but not a sign of you."
He remembers the morning, the damp sheets, her damp forehead. "Liz," he thinks, "didn't you fight? If I had seen your death coming, I would have taken him and beaten in his death's head. I would have crucified him against the wall." The little girls are still up. though someone has put them into their nightdresses, as if it were an ordinary night. Their legs and feet are bare, and their nightcaps, round lace bonnets made by their mother, are knotted under their chins with a resolute hand. Anne's face is like a stone. She has Grace's hand tucked in her fist. Grace looks up at him, dubious. She almost never sees him. Why is he here? But she trusts him and lets him lift her, without protest, into his arms. Against his shoulder she tumbles at once into sleep, her arms flung around his neck, the crown of her head tucked beneath his chin. "Now, Anne," he says, "we must take Grace to bed because she is little. I know you're not ready to sleep yet, but you must go in beside her because she may wake and feel cold."
"I may feel cold," Anne says.
Mercy walks before him to the children's room. Grace is put down without waking. Anne cries, but she cries in silence. "I'll sit with them," Mercy says, but he says, "I will." He waits until Anne's tears stop flowing, and her hand slackens in his. "These things happen, but not to us. Now let me see Liz," he says. The room, which this morning was only their bedroom, is lively with the scent of the herbs they are burning against contagion. They have lit candles at her head and feet. They have bound up her jaw with linen, so already she does not look like herself. She looks like the dead. She looks fearless, and as if she could judge you. She looks flatter and deader than people he has seen on battlefields, with their guts spilled. He goes down to get an account of her deathbed, to deal with the household. At 10 this morning, Mercy said, she sat down. "Jesus, I am so weary, in the middle of the day's business. Not like me, is it?" she'd said. I said, "It's not like you, Liz." I put my hand to her forehead and I said, "Liz, my darling," I told her, "lie down, get to bed with you. You have to sweat this out." She said, "No, give me a few minutes. I'm dizzy. Perhaps I need to eat a little something." But we sat down at the table and she pushed her food away. He would like her to shorten her account, but he understands her need to tell it over, moment by moment, to say it out loud. It is like a package of words she is making to hand to him. "This is yours now." At midday, Elizabeth lay down. She was shivering, though her skin burned. She said, "Is Rafe in the house? Tell him to go and find Thomas." And Rafe did go, and any number of people went, and they didn't find you. At 12:30, she said, "Tell Thomas to look after the children." "And then what?" She complained her head ached. "But nothing to me, no message?" "No." She said she was thirsty, nothing more. But then Liz, she never did say much. At 1:00 she called for a priest. At 2:00 she made her confession. She said she had once picked up a snake in Italy. The priest said it was the fever speaking. He gave her absolution. And he could not wait, Mercy said. He could not wait to get out of the house. He was so afraid he might take the contagion and die. At 3:00 in the afternoon she declined. At 4:00 she put off the burden of this life. "I suppose," he says, "she will want to be buried with her first husband." "Why should you think that?" "Because I came more lately." He walks away. There is no point writing the usual directions about mourning clothes, beadsmen, candles. Like all the others touched by this sickness, Liz must be buried quickly. He will not be able to send for Gregory or call the family together. The rule is for the household to hang a bunch of straw outside the door as a sign of infection, and then restrict entry for 40 days, and go abroad as little as possible. Mercy comes in and says, "A fever, it could be any fever. We don't have to admit to the sweat. If we all stayed at home, London would come to a standstill." No, he says. We must do it. My Lord Cardinal made these rules, and it would not be proper for me to scant them. Mercy says, where were you anyway? He looks into her face. He says, you know, little Bilney? I was with him. I warned him. I said he will jump into the fire. And later? Later I was learning Polish. Of course, you would be, she says. She doesn't expect to make sense of it. He never expects to make any better sense of it than it makes now. He knows the whole of the New Testament by heart, but find a text. Find a text for this. Later, when he thinks back to that morning, he will want to catch again that flash of her white cap, though when he turned, no one was there. He would like to picture her with the bustle and warmth of the household behind her, standing in the doorway saying, "Tell me when you're coming home." But he can only picture her alone at the door, and behind her is a wasteland and a blue-tinged light. He thinks of their wedding night, her trailing taffeta gown, her little wary gesture of hugging her elbows. Next day she said, "That's all right then," and smiled. That's all she left him. Liz, who never did say much. For a month he is at home. He reads. He reads his testament, but he knows what it says. He reads Petrarch, whom he loves. Reads how he defied the doctors. When they had given him up to fever, he lived still. And when they came back in the morning, he was sitting up writing. The poet never trusted any doctor after that. But Liz left him too fast for physician's advice, good or bad, or for the apothecary with his cassia, his galangale, his wormwood, and his printed cards with prayers on. He has got Niccolo Machiavelli's book, Principalities. It is a Latin edition, shoddily printed in Naples, which seems to have passed through many hands. He thinks of Niccolo on the battlefield, of Niccolo in the torture chamber. He feels he's in the torture chamber, but he knows that one day he will find the door out, because it is he who has the key. Someone says to him, "What is in your little book?" And he says, "A few aphorisms, a few truisms, nothing we didn't know before." Whenever he looks up from his book, Rafe Sadler is there. Rafe is a slight boy, and the game with Richard and the others is to pretend not to see him and say, "I wonder where Rafe is." They're as pleased with this joke as a bunch of three-year-olds might be. Rafe's eyes are blue, his hair is sandy brown, and you couldn't take him for a Cromwell. But still, he is a tribute to the man who brought him up, dogged, sardonic, quick on the uptake. He and Rafe read a book about chess. It is a book printed before he was born, but it has pictures. They frown over them, perfecting their game. For what seems like hours, neither of them makes a move. "I was a fool," says Rafe, a forefinger resting on the head of a pawn. "I should have found you. When they said you weren't at Gray's Inn, I should have known you were." "How could you have known? I'm not reliably where I shouldn't be. Are you moving that pawn or just patting it?" "Jaboob." Rafe snatches his hand away. For a long time they sit gazing at their pieces, at the configuration which locks them in place. They see it coming. Stalemate. "We're too good for each other." "Well, perhaps we ought to play against other people." "Later, when we can wipe out all comers." Rafe says, wait. He seizes his knight and makes it leap. Then he looks at the result, aghast. "Rafe, you are foutu." "Not necessarily." Rafe rubs his forehead. "You might yet do something stupid." "Right. You live in hope." Voices murmur. Sunlight outside. He feels he could almost sleep. But when he sleeps, Liz Wicks comes back, cheerful and brisk. and when he wakes he has to learn the Lackifer all over again. From a distant room a child is crying. Footsteps overhead. The crying stops. He picks up his king and looks at the base of it, as if to see how it is made. He murmurs, "Jadoub." He puts it back where it was. Anne Cromwell sits with him as the rain falls and writes her beginner's Latin in her copybook. By St. John's Day, she knows all common verbs. She is quicker than her brother, and he tells her so. "Let me see," he says, holding out his hand for her book. He finds that she has written her name over and over. Anne Cromwell. Anne Cromwell. News comes from France of the cardinal's triumphs, parades, public masses, and extempore Latin orations. It seems that once disembarked, he has stood on every high altar in Picardy and granted the worshippers remission of their sins. That's a few thousand Frenchmen free to start all over again. The king is chiefly at Beaulieu, a house in Essex he has recently bought from Sir Thomas Boleyn, whom he has made Viscount Rochford. All day he hunts, undeterred by the wet weather. In the evening he entertains. The Duke of Suffolk and the Duke of Norfolk join him at private suppers, which they share with the new Viscount. The Duke of Suffolk is his old friend, and if the king said, "Knit me some wings so I may fly," he would say, "What colour?" The Duke of Norfolk is, of course, chief of the Howard family and Boleyn's brother-in-law. A sinewy little twitcher, always twitching after his own advantage. He does not write to the cardinal to tell him that everybody in England is saying that the king means to marry Anne Boleyn. He doesn't have the news the cardinal wants, so he doesn't write at all. He gets his clerks to do it, to keep the cardinal updated on his legal affairs, his finances. "Tell him we are all well here," he says. "Tender him my respects and my duty. Tell him how much we would like to see his face." No one else in the household falls sick. This year London has escaped lightly, or at least everyone says so. Prayers of thanksgiving are offered in the city churches, or prayers of appeasement, perhaps one should call them. In the little conclaves that meet at night, God's purpose is interrogated. London knows that it sins, as the Bible tells us. A merchant shall hardly keep himself from doing wrong. And elsewhere it is stated, "He that maketh haste to be rich shall not be innocent." It is a sure sign of troubled minds, the habit of quotation. "Whom the Lord loveth, he correcteth." By early September the plague has run its course, and the family is able to gather to pray for Liz. Now she can have the ceremonies that were denied her when she left them so suddenly. Black coats are given to 12 poor men of the parish, the same mourners who would have followed her coffin, and each man in the family has pledged 7 years of masses for her soul. On the day appointed, the weather clears briefly, and there is a chill in the air. The harvest is past, the summer is ended, and we are not saved. The small child Grace wakes in the night, and says that she sees her mother in her shroud. She does not cry like a child, noisy and hiccuping, but like a grown woman, weeping tears of dread. All the rivers run into the sea, but the seas are not yet full. Morgan Williams shrinks year by year. Today especially he looks small and grey and harassed as he grips his arm and says, "Why the best taken? Ah, why are they?" Then, "I know you are happy with her, Thomas." They are back at Austin Friars, a swarm of women and children and robust men whom mourning hardly takes out of their customary black, the garb of lawyers and merchants, of accountants and brokers. There is his sister, Bet Wellyfed, her two boys, her little daughter Alice. There is Cat. His sisters have their heads together, deciding who shall move in to help out Mercy with the girls, until you marry again, Tom. His nieces, two good little girls, still clutch their rosary beads. They stare around them, unsure what they must do next. ignored as the people talk over their heads, they lean against the wall and flick their eyes at each other. Slowly they slide down the wall, straight-backed, till they're the height of two-year-olds and balancing on their heels. "Alice! Joanne!" someone snaps. Slowly they rise, solemn-faced, to their proper heights. Grace approaches them. Silently they trap her, take off her cap, shake out her blonde hair and begin to plait it. While the brothers-in-law talk about what the cardinal is doing in France, his attention strays towards her. Grace's eyes grow wide as her cousins draw her hair back tight. Her mouth opens in a silent gape, like a fisher's mouth. When one squeak escapes her, it is Liz's sister, the elder Joanne, who crosses the room and scoops her up. Watching Joanne, he thinks, as he often has, how alike the sisters are, were. His daughter Anne turns her back on the women, slides her arm into her uncle's. "We're talking about the Low Countries trade," Morgan tells her. "One thing's for sure, uncle, they won't be pleased in Antwerp if Wolsey signs a treaty with the French."
"That's what we're saying to your father. But, oh, he was stick by his cardinal. Come, Thomas, you don't like the French any more than we do."
He knows, as they do not, how much the cardinal needs the friendship of King Francois. Without one of the major powers of Europe to speak for him, how will the king get his divorce?
"Treaty of perpetual peace? Let's think, when was the last perpetual peace? I'll give it 3 months."
It is his brother-in-law Wellyfed who speaks, laughing, and John Williamson, who is Joanne's husband, asks will they take bets on it. 3 months? 6? Then he remembers they're at a solemn occasion.
"Sorry, Tom," he says, and breaks into a spasm of coughing.
Joanne's voice cuts across it. "If the old gamester keeps coughing like this, the winter will finish him off. And then I'll marry you, Tom."
"Will you?"
"Oh, for sure. As long as I get the right piece of paper from Rome." The party smile and hide their smiles. They give each other knowing looks. Gregory says, "Why is that funny? You can't marry your wife's sister, can you?" He and his boy cousins go off into a corner to talk about private subjects. Bet's boys, Christopher and Will, Cat's boys, Richard and Walter. Why do they call that child Walter? Do they need a reminder of their father, lurking around after his death, to remind them not to get too happy? The family never meet, but he thanks God that Walter's not with them any more. He tells himself he should have more kindness towards his father, but his kindness extends only to paying for masses for his soul. In the year before he came back to England for good, he had crossed and recrossed the sea undecided. He had so many friends in Antwerp, besides good business contacts, and as the city expanded, which it did every year, it seemed more and more the right place to be. If he was homesick, it was for Italy. The light, the language. Tommaso, as he had been there. Venice had cured him of any nostalgia for the banks of the Thames. Florence and Milan had given him ideas more flexible than those of people who had stayed at home. But something pulled at him. Curiosity about who was dead and who had been born. A desire to see his sisters again and laugh. One can always laugh somehow about their upbringing. He had written to Morgan Williams to say, "I'm thinking of London next. But don't tell my father. Don't tell him I'm coming home." During the early months, they tried to coax him. "Look, Walter's settled down. You wouldn't know him. He's eased back on the drink. Well, he knew it was killing him. He keeps out of the law courts these days. He's even served his turn as church warden." "What?" he said. "And he didn't get drunk on the altar wine. He didn't make off with the candle funds." Nothing they said could persuade him down to Putney. He waited more than a year, till he was married and a father. Then he felt safe to go. It was more than 12 years he'd been out of England. He'd been taken aback by the change in people. He left them young, and they had softened or sharpened into middle age. The lissom were lean now and dried out. The plump were plumper. Fine features had blurred and softened. Bright eyes were duller. There were some people he didn't recognise at all, not at first glance. But he would have known Walter anywhere. As his father walked towards him, he thought, I'm seeing myself in 20, 30 years, if I'm spared. They said that drink had nearly done for him, but he didn't look half dead. He looked as he had always looked, as if he could knock you down and might decide to do it. His short, strong body had broadened and coarsened. His hair, thick and curling, had hardly a thread of grey. His glance was skewering, small eyes, bright and golden brown. You need good eyes in a smithy, he used to say. You need good eyes wherever you are, or they'll rob you blind. Where have you been? Walter said. Where once he would have sounded angry, he now sounded merely irritated. It was as if his own son had been on a message to Mortlake and had taken his time over it. Oh, here and there, he said. You look like a foreigner. I am a foreigner. So what have you been doing? He could imagine himself saying this and that. He did say it. And what sort of this and that are you doing now? I'm learning the law. Law? Walter said. If it weren't for the so-called law, we'd be lords of the manor and a whole lot of other manors around here. That is, he thinks, an interesting point to make. If you get to be a lord by fighting, shouting, being bigger, better, bolder, and more shameless than the next man, Walter should be a lord. But it's worse than that. Walter thinks he's entitled. He'd heard it all his childhood. The Cromwells were a rich family once. We had estates. When? Where? He used to say. Walter would say, somewhere up in the north, up there, and yell at him for quibbling. His father didn't like to be disbelieved, even when he was telling you an outright lie. So how do we come to such a low place? He would ask, and Walter would say it was because of lawyers and cheats and lawyers who are all cheats and who thieve land away from its owners. Understand it if you can, Walter would say, for I can't, and I'm not stupid, boy. How dare they drag me into court and fine me for running beast on the so-called common? If all had their own, that would be my common. Now, if the family's land was in the north, how could that be? No point saying this. In fact, it's the quickest way to get a lesson from Walter's fist. But was there no money? He'd persist. What happened to it? Just once, when he was sober, Walter had said something that sounded true and was, by his lights, eloquent. I suppose, he said, I suppose we pissed it away. I suppose once it's gone, it's gone. I suppose fortune, when it's lost, it will never visit again. He thought about it over the years. On that day when he went back to Putney, he'd ask him, if ever the Cromwells were rich, and I were to go after what's left, would that content you? His tone was meant to be soothing, but Walter was hard to soothe. Oh, yes, and share it out, I suppose. You and bloody Morgan that you're so thick with. That's my money, if all have their own. It would be family money. What are we doing, he thought, quarrelling right off, rowing within 5 minutes over this non-existent wealth. You have a grandson now, he added, not aloud, and you aren't coming anywhere near him. Oh, I have those already, Walter said. Grandsons? What is she, some Dutch girl? He told him about Liz Wicks, admitting, therefore, that he had been in England long enough to marry and have a child. Caught yourself a rich widow, Walter said, sniggering. I suppose that was more important than coming to see me. It would be. I suppose you thought I'd be dead. Lawyer, is it? You were always a talker. A slap in the mouth couldn't cure it. But God knows you tried. I suppose you don't admit to the smithy work now, or helping your Uncle John and sleeping among the turnip shavings. Good God, Father, he'd said. They didn't eat turnips at Lambeth Palace. Cardinal Morton eat turnips. What are you thinking? When he was a little boy and his Uncle John was a cook for the great man, he used to run away to Lambeth to the palace, because the chances of getting fed were better.